Today's episode of the Day Chang Show is brought to you by Yahoo Fantasy Football. We've all made some bad choices in life. I know I have. Last year's Super Bowl, I bet the Rams. I lost badly. I really am still pissed off about it. But this isn't about me. It's about you. Don't make where you play fantasy football a bad life decision. Play Yahoo Fantasy Football. Yahoo offers free expert advice. It has the best player experience, and they'll never delete your league history like other apps. Yahoo also has all kinds of fantasy games, like the new Best Ball, Just Draft, and You're Done. No trades, no waivers, no drama, all season. Yahoo is the number one rated app by the FSGA. I love Yahoo Fantasy Football. It has literally been my league since I started fantasy football. It is my fantasy league of choice, and it's where I win and beat all my friends. You should do the same. Make better choices. Choose Yahoo Fantasy Football. And now, the Day Chang Show. Welcome to the Day Chang Show, part of the Ringer Podcast Network, presented by Major Domo Media. Today's guest is the ceramicist, pottery expert, Adam Field. You may not know of him. He is a celebrated ceramicist that made a lot of our ongis and the stuff that we use in our restaurant, Major Domo, in Los Angeles. An ongi is essentially Korean Tupperware that's made out of earthenware clay. And it's a very functional, I don't know, use of the kitchen, right? You ferment stuff in it. You hold dry goods and rice in it. It's something I grew up with my mom and grandma using quite a bit. And so when you go to Korea, you see how it's stored outside. When you go to the countryside, a little less so in the city today. And it's just a wonderful piece of Korean culture. So I was excited to get an American artist that went to Korea to learn how to make this thing that is wildly uncool, which makes it, in my opinion, incredibly cool. And it's exciting to see his work and his ongi being more and more sort of popular in restaurants, and not just as decoration, something that is highly functional. So that's something that we're going to get to. I didn't really know that I was going to talk about pottery and Asian pottery as art. And if you've been listening to this podcast, you know, we talk quite a bit about it with Rick Taravanesia and then Roberta Smith. And the idea of Korean and Asian culinary equipment as art. And during the Roberta Smith interview, I told her something that I've mentioned in other podcasts that I've done, but it really does sort of frame and contextualize this conversation with Adam. I had a few months ago, I had was preparing to speak with Roberta. And I was trying to learn as much of her writing as possible because I didn't want to waste her time because I'm not an art expert. I know nothing about art. And when I was reading more and more of her work and reading more and more of her interviews and looking at the stuff that she's done on YouTube and stuff, the one thing I read over and over again, actually, was a piece she wrote in 2000 about Korean ceramics. And I swear to God, my wife and I were reading it in bed and we were moved to tears by what she'd written, because it made us so proud of our Korean heritage, you know, which often gets buried under Japanese and Chinese influence because of the sort of the turbulent history Korea has had. If you know anything about Korean history, you know how painful it's been with those countries, whether it was the Mongol horde, whether it was Japan occupation or Chinese rule. And then obviously later with the Korean War and American influence. And, you know, it made me think, if a white American critic in 2000, without any real sort of resources from the internet, you can tell very clearly she did her homework through book research, spending time in the libraries and such. You know, I don't know for sure, but if you read this article, and I should make a link, if Roberta Smith could write about Korean pottery with the same kind of knowledge and nuance 20 years ago, why can't people today approach Korean food and have the same kind of understanding? And to me, that review that she did of Korean pottery exhibit that was a special at the Met in 2000, to me is the benchmark for writing reviews about something you're not an expert in. And I know that there's been more and more sort of talk from food media and criticism about being honest about cuisines you may not know something about. I have a lot to say. I'm still developing some of those ideas, but today is not the time or place to talk about that. So it might seem like a trivial thing to you, but I think that it's really problematic, and having distinct identities matter just as much to Asian people as to any others. And speaking of Asian identity and distinct identities, you know, before I get into the podcast with Adam, I wanted to give you the quick little segment of my opinion as fact. Recently, I was at a terrific restaurant called Shoji in Tribeca, and I had a wonderful date night and delicious sushi from Chef Derek, who I met a decade ago when I staged at Kikunoi in Kyoto under Chef Murata-san, and it was wonderful to see him again, and I didn't even know that he was the chef there, so it was quite a surprise to see him. I would say I walked into that restaurant, it definitely felt like a modern sushi-ya in Japan. And what I'm about to say, I'm certain is going to be, I won't say confusing and contradictory, but because I very much hate authenticity, but I love authenticity when it's about preserving something. And one of my great pet peeves, being a loud, obnoxious American myself, is when I'm traveling in Japan and I go to restaurants, and it's not just Americans, but non-Japanese people that are incredibly rude by speaking loudly and not eating with the right etiquette and protocol. And I have a lot of sort of weird feelings because in some ways I'm a Japanophile, right? Like, as I learn more about my Korean culture and history, like, that's a real sort of troublesome thing at times because of my identity and how my grandfather was essentially Japanese. And, you know, I don't really need to read that book, Pachinko, because there was a lot of like parallels to my life and my family. So the whole relation of Korea and Japan is a very weird thing, which is why I always find it funny to me that I want to be as respectful as possible. So quite contradictory to Japanese culture, particularly to how people eat in Japanese restaurants. And it's something that Brian Kopelman and the team at Billions sort of nailed in one of the earlier episodes, seasons of Billions, when the Wags was eating sushi and he just completely berated and went nuclear apeshit on one investment bro because they were just eating and being a jerk by just dunking soy sauce on all this beautiful sushi. And I think that there's two ways to really eat sushi. One, you have sort of the spicy tuna roll that you get for delivery or the Whole Foods or sugarfish. And I know people like sugarfish. I just personally don't. You know, you can, those are just fun calories and you can eat them as you wish. Put soy sauce, put cheese powder, who gives a shit? It's just whatever it is. And that's one way of eating. And listen, I'm guilty of doing that shit too, because I love a imitation California roll and spicy tuna crunchy and all that shit. But when there are moments to go to a place where you see the true artistry and craftsmanship of a sushi chef, particularly someone like Derek that's trying to do something that's hyper-local and seasonal with his netta. I think most of it happens to come from local waters. The last thing you want to see is someone just popping the pickled ginger and eating a whole bowl of it like it's popcorn and then not having wasabi and then adding for ponzu sauce and then just dunking everything in the soy sauce. My eyes were, I just was freaking out. And, you know, my wife had to calm me down and I very much wanted to be Wags. And listen, I can understand how much I can sound like a hypocrite. Like, everyone should eat the way they want to. You have every right to eat like a total idiot at a sushi restaurant. I get it. But for fuck's sake, like, don't eat there then. Eat somewhere else. There's a time and place to eat that way. But when you are really sort of trying to appreciate artistry and craftsmanship, I think it's wildly disrespectful to eat like an idiot. And I will say that, like, I can dunk my shit in soy sauce and eat pickled ginger like anyone else, but there's a time and place for everything. And I do not believe it's at a place where someone is sort of showcasing the very best elements of Japanese culture in omakase. And that's just how they're eating. They're also obnoxiously loud. And this is coming from an obnoxiously loud person like myself. And if I can shut the fuck up and have a wonderful time and speak in a low manner, so can these bros. And this is coming from a reformed bro himself, right? So please, don't be that person. Be respectful. Do your homework. It's not that hard. There's etiquette in certain restaurants. I don't know if they would do this in other restaurants, but imagine sometimes you're going to the ballet or the orchestra at Lincoln Center or something. You just don't act like a jerk. And to the credit of the shoji team, I thought it was pretty cool that they were just sort of like rolling with the punches. And listen, I could be, and I'm not just could be, I'm certain that I'm making a bigger deal out of this than possible because I could be the jerk myself. I get that. And there's multiple truths. So maybe I'm a total asshole, probably. Anyway, I wanted to talk about identity in relation to Korean pottery, identity when it comes to eating in a Japanese restaurant and being respectful to that. I will shut the fuck up now. Here's my conversation with Adam Field. I am with, would you say Master Potter?
No, actually, I'm glad you brought that up right off the bat. Having apprenticed in Korea under some traditional potters, people want to call me a master, but I spent a solid year working there as an apprentice.
So Adam Field, Potter.
Potter? Yeah, Potter.
That's ceramicist or Potter? Card.
Potter.
Potter.
Yeah.
So it's not ceramicist.
I mean, it is that, but I think more specifically, I would say Potter. Just because a Potter. Ceramicist can make ceramic sculpture. They can make anything. Essentially, if clay is fired, then it becomes ceramic. So anybody who's firing clay is a ceramicist.
And when does someone become, is there such a level master potter?
Sure.
Master ceramicist? Who gives those titles out?
I mean, I can tell you that Kim Il-man, who was my ongi master teacher in Korea, he's a master. And I mean, he's designated.
Nationally
designated. Intangible cultural treasure is his designation.
And what's that in Korea? So Japan has the national living treasure.
Right.
Korea's is worded differently.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on who's translating it. But I mean, the phrase that I commonly use is intangible cultural treasure.
And basically means you are best in class in your field that offers such a level of excellence that culture needs to celebrate you while you're alive.
And it's like, I look at it like a living museum. The country has a national vested interest in supporting people that are carrying on these traditions that go way, way back.
So when someone calls you, like someone calls me celebrity chef, I'm like, no, never use that in fucking term again. And if someone calls you master potter, you're just like, no, I'm just a potter.
Yeah, I'm a potter.
If someone is a master potter, is it like the suffix like a sir? Do you are like, no, I earned the title master, so call me master potter?
Well, I mean—
Or do you just like whatever?
To put it in the context that I have for that is like mostly in Korea. And so, I mean, it's going to be the highest respectful conjugation, right? Sunsaengnim is who my teacher is, you know.
And Adam's Korean's way better than mine.
My kids are even far better than that.
So let's back up.
Okay.
You are a potter. You've been making a variety of ceramics, spent time working in Korea.
Right.
And I wanted to have you on because one of the subjects that sort of repeated itself in this podcast is the idea of craftsmanship, the idea of art, and also the idea of stories that aren't being told. And one of the things that, again, I've spoken about without being an expert on is Korean pottery. And less about the pottery itself, which I'm happy to talk to you about, but more about how it has been not told for many years exactly what happened. And some people know, some people don't, but it's almost a good litmus test to see if some parts of the world and culture are aware of what happened with Korean pottery. And if you can be aware about the history of Korean pottery, then why are we not aware about everything else?
Yeah.
And not just Korean pottery, right? There are things out there that, you know, the truth is out there, but some people don't want to know, or it's just too hard to believe.
Well, there are some pretty difficult things tied to those truths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's my sort of benchmark these days, is if people in American sort of art history or global art history can sort of celebrate, and they knew the significance of Korean pottery over the past sort of, when do you think it started to happen where in America people were like, well, Korean pottery is amazing?
Well, and I want a disclaimer, like I'm by no means a historian.
You know more than
here,
anyone else listening to
more
this.
More than most of the people, yeah. So what happened, and I believe it was in the 50s or 60s, there was a potter from England named Bernard Leach. And he spent a whole lot of time in Japan way, way back. And Shoji Hamada was this Japanese master potter. They toured across the U.S. and they did demonstrations, they gave lectures, and that kind of planted the seeds across America for this appreciation for folk pottery that celebrated the nameless craftsperson. Well, when you start digging deep into that aesthetic in Japan, then it actually goes back one step further or two, which would be Korean influence and Chinese influence. To take it all the way back, that's where it goes. But more recently, I'm not sure. I think that a lot of Korean ceramic aesthetic is very simple, very clean. And, you know, with trends in architecture, I think that fits.
But it's been in discussion, right? If you make pottery, you realize, when did you realize, like, whoa, Koreans sort of reached the pinnacle of this craft?
Well, you know, I came out of college with very little understanding of that background. And then I moved to the Bay Area and I was working at a ceramic supply store, but then that was part-time. The other time I was headed up to the Napa Valley where I did kind of an informal internship up there.
And that's when you were getting into pottery.
Yeah. So that's when I was going from academic. I mean, I just got a bachelor's degree in art, so very basic level, and moved to San Francisco, and it was like, everywhere I looked, there was amazing pottery and people that were taking it a lot more seriously than I had seen before. So anyways, I was doing this kind of residency, let's call it, near St. Helena in the Napa Valley there with Richard Carter. And he really instilled this appreciation for historical Korean aesthetic in the ceramic realm in me. And so he had amazing books that I would just kind of spend hours and hours looking through all these books. And it gave me this appreciation. It opened my eyes to the fact that there's something other than these drippy, bright red, bright blue, copper blue glazes that you see at different craft fairs and stuff like that, which is what I had only seen up to that point.
And for those that don't know, if you want to give a primer before we go back into your career, how does pottery break out in Asia? Like, how did it, what's the main schools and what's the most sought after? What's the most valuable and who did it best?
Well, if we're talking about perfection,
yeah,
China is the first word that comes to mind. I mean, there's a reason that porcelain is also referred to as China. You know, they were this extremely powerful empire and they had a monopoly on it because they figured out what ingredients went into making porcelain.
And how do you make porcelain?
I'm not telling. No. Essentially, it is weathered stone. And if it's kaolinite, which is a very pure form of weathered stone, then it's going to be white like porcelain. But the secret kind of ingredient that they held on to for so long, very close to their chest, was feldspar. So that's the pink that you see in granite. And when you pulverize it and mix it in with this kaolin, then it brings the melting point down and then it starts to ring like a bell and it's translucent and it's glass-like, and not a lot of the other places around the world had seen that technology before. And so through the Silk Road. Yeah, the Silk Road. Thank you. Those wares made it to the Middle East and they made it to Europe, and all of a sudden these porcelain wares were valued more than gold. And so then the race was on to figure out, the alchemists were actually working on figuring out in Europe how to replicate it. And they tried everything under the sun.
What era is this?
This is like pre 1600s.
China's figured out how to make already basically just most beautiful vases and pottery already, right?
Yeah.
Like not much has changed since then.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, like there, you can always refine and refine and refine. But yeah, I mean, they had it at an extremely high level already.
And they got there through what? Just sheer trial and error, right?
I don't know.
How did something so exquisite and beautiful happen?
I imagine so. I mean, I think it was probably very methodical. And, you know, I think about like, you know, the invention of gunpowder. It's like, well, how do you come up with that? There's all these different things. And they just had this approach that was, I would say, very scientific.
So they figured out almost everything in the world of antiquity, basically.
Right. Yeah. So to finish on this European side, though, the thing that's really interesting is that these alchemists, they tried everything under the sun until somebody burned some cattle bones and they took the ash and they mixed it in as this kind of obscure ingredient and they figured it out because it's a very similar mix of chemicals in cattle bones as you would have with that feldspar. And that's where you get bone china from.
I recently was at Blue Hill Stone Barns and had a terrific meal, and all of their china is beautiful.
Yeah.
I don't know the ceramicist that made it, but it's all from the cattle bones from the farms there.
Mm.
The plates, the cups, they're all literally bone china.
Yeah.
And I was such a dumbass. I was like, oh, bone china literally means bone china.
There's such a thing as vegan pottery. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It's bones. It's the calcium. It acts as a flux and it melts all those ingredients. And that's why it
And it's very sturdy.
Works. Yeah.
That was like a head scratcher because I felt like such a dumbass.
Well, I mean, it's one of those
things. You thought it was just a euphemism.
Think about it. Yeah.
And so the Europeans figured out bone china.
Yeah.
The Chinese did not figure that out.
That's correct.
And then, so again, I know nothing about any pottery history, right? So other than I can imagine the beautiful vases and the intricate design work that the Chinese figured out how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was after that?
Well, I mean, chronologically, there were a lot of different things happening, but I mean, I could probably talk more about like what the, you know, epitome of some different cultures in the Far East are. So, you know, if you go to Korea, some of the most sought after wares there are going to be the Cheongja or the green ware, which is celadon stoneware. And there's a lot of very intricate inlay that gets carved into it. Say it's a grayish brown clay, carve into it, very intricately paint a different colored clay over the top. And then you scrape away and anything that you carve now is inlaid with those different colors. And so you have some of the most amazing sangam is the term for that in Korean.
And they invented that technique.
That's a hard thing to say with ceramics because there are techniques that came up out of their own all around the world. Right. But I'd say that when you see that also in Japan, referred to as Mishima, both of those are very much famous from those two locations. And the thing that I always like to point out here, and this starts to get into some of those difficult truths, is that you know, in the clay field, people will refer to this term, this technique as Mishima, when in fact it was a technique that originated in Korea and was brought over to Japan when potters, which were a big asset, were kidnapped and taken to
the Mishima area.
To the Mishima area. And so now, hey, this is Mishima, was the result. And it stuck. And so anytime I teach a workshop, which that's a big part of what I do in my work, I make sure to just share that part of the story.
Are there people that get incredibly upset when you try to correct them?
No, I'd say it's the opposite. I think that it can be upsetting when you're just kind of across the board calling it Mishima. And if you're talking about something in the Seoul National Museum as having Mishima decoration, you know, I mean, I listen to your podcast a lot. So it's the same thing as saying like, you know, I had some really great miso at the Korean restaurant the other night.
And it seems harmless, but it actually is loaded with much more difficult things.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. There's bad blood.
So if you were going to describe how Korean pottery came out of China, what was the difference between Chinese pottery and then Korean pottery that started to develop, the 14th, 15th century?
Well, it goes a lot farther back than that. But as far as like, you know, we were talking about the pinnacle, but, you know, that's subjective. But so Korean pottery, as it relates to China, the way that I think about it is that you have, you know, a lot of trade happening because Korea is just like right kind of surrounded by China there. And you have a tradesperson going across and they maybe saw something that looked really amazing to them in China. And they came back and they told their potter friend like, oh, we need to start making these because we could make really good money doing it. And then that Korean potter goes and they're like, oh, I know where there's a vein of clay out, you know, behind my house. I can go dig that up and refine it as much as I can, which is nowhere near the resources you would find in China and wealth, you know, that you would find, frankly, at that point. And so the clay doesn't get refined quite as well. And maybe that potter doesn't quite have as good of a wheel, and maybe they don't have quite as, you know, many people to help firing a kiln. And so what you get is you get some of the character of the reality of the situation in Korea that seeps its way into the aesthetic. And so if you look at these forms that are very similar to what was being made in China at the same exact time, but in Korea, you'll see that they have a lot more life, a lot more perfectly imperfect, to use a phrase that you've used on this podcast before. And that really defines the Korean aesthetic, and it makes its way into Korean architecture specifically. That's one of the things that I love seeing, where those lines aren't always perfectly straight. And with ceramics, maybe there are some iron spots that didn't get refined out. And so instead of having a perfectly white China porcelain vase, you'll have some iron spots like people. We have freckles, you know? And so that iron has a way of burning out into the finished look of the piece.
So by trying to emulate China with their own sort of terroir and their own know-how of trying to copy China, they created their own way of making pottery that was distinctly different because it could never be the exquisite sort of perfection that the Chinese were doing.
That seems like a bold statement for me to make publicly right here.
I want you to agree to that.
No, I mean, I want to be very careful to say that definitely Korea had their own original aspirations in making pottery. But I mean, when you have a big brother that is overshadowing in a lot of ways, I think that that makes its way into it.
But the style that, like, for those that don't know anything about this, and put me in that camp, even though I'm a bit familiar with it, how would you describe what Korean pottery that became famous for?
Yeah.
Like, what does it look like?
It's so alive. When I look at it, especially as somebody who works with clay, and this is one of the reasons, you know, I'm here in New York this week, I'm going to go to the Met, because I love looking back at historical ceramics as a potter and saying, I know by looking at that, how that clay felt to the person who was shaping it. And it has that life in it where if you go to China at the same time, you're not going to get a sense of the materials quite as much because it is perfectly refined shape-wise until the hand has been worked out of it. And so I think that that is something that is characteristically Korean in ceramics.
What is it about Korean culture that allows that to sort of proliferate?
Bali, Bali. Hurry up. Get it made. Get it done. On to the next. We need to, you know, put food on the table. And to bring it over in a different direction, there were potters that were breakneck pace making these rice bowls because every one of those bowls they made maybe put a few extra cents on their table. And then, long story very short, those pots were brought to Japan and they fit with the religious, social ideas that were happening at the time.
Which
and all of a sudden, they were Buddhist, to put it very simply, but they were very highly sought after. And if you look at the price tags on these peasant tea bowls from Korea, now put into a different context of Japan, they're as much as you could ever want to spend and more.
Right. Literally priceless.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know what the prices are because they say it's priceless.
Yeah.
So how much would one of these, which looks like rough hewn tea ceremony bowls,
childware.
Like I could, I mean, honestly, I was like, I could have made that.
Yeah.
But they're like, well, that's like, you could never afford that. Because they look like, again, a child made them.
Yeah.
They look very rough.
Oh, and so here we go. So here's where it fits with the aesthetic is that, you know, there is this lack of self-consciousness that goes with the making of a pot when you're racing to get the next one made and the next one made, that you're not going to be able to replicate when you're like, how can I make this one tea bowl just perfect? And it shows. And if you're not thinking about it and it's flying off the wheel onto the next, then that's where something that I think really is part of the Korean aesthetic. And so to put it into one word, maybe there's a pinch of desperation in there.
Hmm.
You know?
Wow, that's beautiful. And now a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Today's episode of The Dave Chang Show is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/Chang. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. That's right, free. ZipRecruiter.com/Chang. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Chang. C-H-A-N-G. ZipRecruiter.com/Chang. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's episode of The Dave Chang Show is also brought to you by Audible. Listen up, Amazon Prime members. For a limited time, you can start an Audible membership and save 66% on your first 3 months, a total of $30 off. That's like getting 3 months for the price of one. You'll pay just $4.95 per month for the first 3 months. After that, it's only $14.95 per month. This summer, get up close and personal with TV personality and restaurateur Marcus Samuelson in his next generation cookbook, Our Harlem. Our Harlem is an Audible original production that explores the rich culture and identity of Harlem through the food, culture, and people who have made Harlem an iconic New York neighborhood. Check out his restaurant, Red Rooster. It's fantastic. Big shout out to Marcus. Each chapter is a day of the week where you explore themes like the Great Migration and Spanish Harlem in conversation with Harlem personalities like Bevy Smith, Dapper Dan, and Jelani Cobb. Listen anytime, anywhere with Audible. Visit audible.com/majordomo or text majordomo, M-A-J-O-R-D-O-M-O, to 500-500 to get started today. That's Audible, audible.com/majordomo or text majordomo to 500-500. Offer is valid from now through July 31st, and there's tons of other books that you can listen to on Audible. And now, back to the show. I'm trying to imagine how to explain this to people because you spent a lot of time in Korea.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's in the DNA.
Yeah.
Right? The
Han.
It's the Han. Yeah. Fuck. I mean, I can't remember who, and I was reading this article about a Korean architect, and he was talking about the relationship between Muk and Byun, like the desire for Koreans to just do it without being too overly cautious. Or
yeah.
Just getting shit done.
Yeah.
And making it look rough or imperfect, but also like intentionally so.
To a degree. I mean, you go back before like marketplaces was, you know, what it is right now. I don't know that that was some, it was like, just get it done, because in a very indirect way, I think it was like, because if you just keep getting it done, then you're going to be supported.
But what does it have to do with the concept of sort of like clearing out simultaneously? It's the idea of like to create and also to sort of almost like not destroy per se, but to like rein that in, that
clearing
impulse.
Out.
Yeah. I wish I had the article in front of me again, but it, when I read it, I was like, oh, that's just Korea. That's just, yeah. I guess more or less is, it was almost the idea, the Japanese popularized the idea of wabi-sabi.
Yeah.
And almost, I would say a lot of people, are you familiar with wabi-sabi? Yeah. What's wabi-sabi?
Wabi-sabi is, and you know, I'm not going to get it just right here, but the way that I think of wabi-sabi is that it is this idea of side-by-side fresh with the old. And so if you have a wood-fired pot is a process that is very tough on the pottery. And so if you pull it out of the kiln after firing it with wood for 10 days and there's a crack on the pot, then that starts to speak of nature. and process. And so that could be a crack in Japanese culture that would be celebrated and filled in with gold. And so it's highlighting the fact that there is some imperfection. Or, you know, I think about a very rough piece of pottery with maybe one flower and a leaf that is set inside of it and maybe just a drop of water in the right spot. It's contrast. It's counterpoint.
From what I gather, though, and yeah. Again, I'd love your take on this. Wabi-sabi to me is trying to make it look like we intentionally tried to make it look like we didn't try to make it.
So you know what I mean? Favorite quotes on this is that if it looks overworked, then it wasn't overworked enough.
So like there's a sense like when I interpret wabi-sabi, it's like someone tried to make it look like that.
Yeah. And I don't know that that's the purest sense of it. I mean, right. I think that there are definitely people and traditions that are very good at that. But I think at its heart, originally, it was maybe, you know, appreciating something. I mean, I don't know. There's this great gallery that I always go to in San Francisco, and they specialize in Japanese antiques, but also contemporary artifacts as well. And this most amazing sculpture, it was maybe like a 6-inch tall by 18-inch square tile. And right on one side of it in the middle, there was this really soft depression. And I started talking to the guy about it, and he explained to me that this was a stair step from the entrance off of an alley into somebody's home in Japan. And over the last 500 years, it got worn soft in that one spot. Hmm. And so I think there's an element of wabi-sabi in that.
Then how would you, this is very difficult to talk about, then how would you characterize what you said was perfectly imperfect, right? Korean pottery and almost the culture of Korea.
Yeah.
How is that different than wabi-sabi? Because it really is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one.
It's a distinct difference, but it's very hard to articulate. Like one's intentional. I feel the other one is just, it is.
it's like you said, it's more ingrained in the DNA. And the word hardy comes to mind when I'm thinking of like Korean, whether it's architecture or pottery, it's a little more coarsely ground, so to speak.
But it's this weird paradox of being elegant and roughshod. And it's so hard to describe because that to me is just Korea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would point listeners to, you know, Google the phrase moon jar, because the moon is pretty much a perfect circle on the right night of the month. But you look at these moon jars that are kind of like a very much a national treasure in Korea. And do you have a sense in your mind what a moon jar is?
Yes.
I mean, it's a spherical white jar, but when you really start looking at it, it's undulating and the line is not perfectly circle. And they probably fired the kiln a little too hot at some point. And so it's drooping a little bit. And it's like, it has so many characteristics of the type of clay, the type of firing, and the person that made it into it, that is like the spirit of Korean ceramics. It's not perfect.
It's like they have every intent to make it perfect, but they can't. You know what I mean? Like, there's something that like prevents it from happening. It's like it's not like they don't want to, right? Even if you look at Korean houses and architecture, it's very different than the Japanese, even though from a distance, it all looks the same, but
right.
It's not.
When you focus in, it's not. And one thing that I'll point out is that having lived in Icheon, which is a big center of ceramics in Korea, you go to the big hotel where the Mogyoktang, where the public bath is, and you'll see all kinds of tourist ceramics because it's a ceramics town. And everything in there is over-refined, and it's kind of closer to that historical Chinese version because it's like has to be perfect. But the idea of perfect has changed in the last 500 years. And so the newer stuff, I find that I really don't like it quite as much as that historical stuff because it had that Koreanness to it. And I guess I don't want to like throw the newer stuff under the bus because there are people doing amazing things. But
the, when you say Koreanness, for a listener that knows nothing about Korea or someone that is Korean and they're looking for some representation or validation from someone else, and if you can talk about it in pottery terms, what is the Koreanness of Korean pottery?
Yeah.
This is my show and I'm Korean, so I want to know too for myself.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, there's a softness to it, visually speaking. So you're not going to have like these crisp, sharp edges historically, you know, looking at the pots. Usually there it's a very subtle, single, like monochromatic glaze. The clay, like I said, it's not going to be overly refined. And again, I'm talking about historical examples because you look at porcelain in Korea now and it's as pure and white as you would want to get. And I think very importantly to it, and this is something we haven't really gotten into yet, is functionality. Yes. It's important. It needs to be practical. And it's really interesting what happens to a ceramic object when you place this idea of function on it. Because is it sitting in a museum at, you know, in Priceless, or is that something that is meant to pour water into your cup at the restaurant? You know, it's not a long distance between the two.
Mm. And again, I can't for the life of me ever explain to anyone, let alone yourself, the difference between anything that's Korean versus Chinese versus Japanese. Mm-hmm. But when I start to think about the cuisine, I'm like, oh, it makes total sense. It's like Korean food versus Chinese food versus Japanese food is essentially the exact same sort of difference to me when you look at the pottery.
Yeah. It's very clear to you what those differences are. Yeah. And if we're talking about Japanese, Korean, Chinese pottery, it's clear. But I've, you know, isolated my brain for the last 21 years to focusing on that stuff. So it's subtleties.
Would you say, for someone that is more aware of it than most, that there is some kind of parallel if you look at the food and the differences between those three regions and understanding the differences in the pottery? Is there some kind of parallel?
Are you asking if there's a thread that kind of spans the
same,
three?
Almost the same kinds of difference, even though it's like I'm talking about food and but the aesthetics of it and even the flavors of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely an aesthetic thread. I think you always, when talking about the Far East, need to not underestimate the influence of China.
This is everything.
I mean, and I'm sure food is probably similar with that.
Everything came. I mean, there's still Chinese words that are used in Korea.
Yeah.
The kanji is used in Japan. It is throughout everything. But there is, but if I've never been to the Far East before Asia, I don't know if I'd ever know the difference between those three cuisines.
Yeah.
Because like from a distance, they all look the same too. But upon closer inspection, they're apples and oranges.
Yeah.
So what was it about Korea? All right. You're in St. Helena. You're reading all these books. And you're like, and you're practicing pottery now. You're throwing more clay.
Yeah. Right. Well, so at this point, I did have a job working at a ceramic supply store down in San Francisco area, and my boss was really great. He said, "Here's $500 to each of my employees to take workshops throughout the year." He wanted an educated workforce, and that was like my introduction into a less academic realm. Because when you step into a workshop, it's very different than a classroom in a lot of ways. A little more hands-on, a little more practical. And the potters that I was choosing to learn from were, for the most part, making a go of it in the studio as practicing studio potters for themselves. So that was like what planted the seed for me to realize that I enjoyed learning by doing, which was the impetus for, you know, the Korean apprenticeship eventually. And so ended up eventually moving to Maui, and I had promised myself, okay, I can take a job as long as it leads to somehow making a living in clay. So I was moving furniture on Maui for a little while. And the good thing about that is that I met all the interior designers. And then I started to, you know, drop business cards here and there and say, I'd love to work with you on projects. And through that, was able to line up selling at the Four Seasons Resort, has an artist program that is amazing. You know, you get to sell to a very captive audience that can afford the work. And for me,
What are you making around this time?
I had really kind of swallowed the Kool-Aid at that St. Helena gig as far as just being that unknown craftsman. So I was making tableware. I was making plates, bowls, cups, and very simple white glaze, green glaze, black glaze. And I wasn't signing in. Like, I had my ideals lined up in front of me.
So do you think at this time you're like, I'm fucking great?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you said that too. Yeah.
I'm so good.
Yeah. So we, you know, we were making really good money. And my now ex-wife is an excellent potter. Hisu Lee, you guys should look up her work. And we were both selling out of the Four Seasons. And we got to the point where we were, between the two of us, making six figures as potters, which is unusual, I think, as studio potters. Granted, it was before 2008, but it was amazing. And we were really badass. So we thought. And then.
How many years you spend there? Three, you said?
Well, total in Hawaii, 5 years, okay. But it took a few years to work into this Four Seasons gig. Was really,
so you were like, I never thought I'd be making this kind of money.
Yeah.
And doing what I actually want to
do. Saving money and living in paradise and all that. And then one day I went home and there was a message on the actual answering machine, which is what you had back in those days. And it was my brother saying to give him a call. And I got the worst call I ever could, which was that my father had passed away. And all of a sudden, like, life goes on outside of paradise. And so it was time to like reset priorities and think about family. And so by then we had our son, Juno, was born out there on Maui, and we wanted him to get to know the family in Korea and the language before he started school in the States. And so we were lucky to have had that money to be able to move to Korea. And through my mother-in-law, I was able to set up an apprenticeship while my son was in school there, learning Korean and getting to spend time with grandma and aunties and uncles and all that stuff. And that was, had I researched the perfect place to do an apprenticeship, I wouldn't have found a better place than what my mother-in-law just kind of nonchalantly was like, check this place out.
What year is this?
We moved over there in at the end of 2007. So my apprenticeship took place over all of 2008.
And how was your Hanguk then?
I mean, I spoke with my son Juno, who was 3.5, somewhat. And I had been with Hisu at that point for about 7 years. So I had a baseline. I had been to Korea maybe 4 or 5 times before that.
And now you're just trying to make Korean pottery.
So now—
Before, when you were at the Four Seasons, what you were making type of stuff?
No, I was making American, kind of was the baseline, American style pottery, which is heavily influenced by Japanese pottery. And I was looking at Korean pots as well. And had a healthy, you know, appreciation for all of the above. But, you know, the idea is that you figure out what your own style is. And I was figuring that out. In Hawaii, I wanted to make something that was of that place. You don't have ceramic traditions in Hawaii because the mountains and the land is too young. So there's a lot of basketry. There's a lot of weaving and textiles. And so I started carving these very intricate, what looked like weaving patterns into my work. And so that's what I had been doing in Hawaii and what I was selling at the Four Seasons.
But like the idea of making Korean pottery was like still not there.
No.
Until you get to Korea in 2007.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, I've been doing all of this carved work, which is kind of what you see in Korea as well, but it was very different in style. And I thought, if I really want to learn something, then I need to focus on the thing that's at the opposite end of the spectrum, which for me was the kind of peasantry pottery. And I chose like the pre-refrigerator, the pre-Tupperware of Korean ceramics, which is ongi. And I like to point out to people, if I'm among academic Korean potters, it does me no good to mention that I studied ongi. They're like, great, so you collected garbage, essentially would be the comparable. It is seeing more respect, absolutely, these days. But historically, you know, this is something that was for everyone. There would be an ongi.
You're making Tupperwares.
Yeah. And refrigerators, you know, I mean. But the thing is everybody uses
that. So for those that don't know, I mean, you can Google or look up what an ongi looks like. But where is an ongi in a traditional Korean household?
It's either on the patio right outside the house for the larger ones. And, you know, think not quite as large as a trash can. They get quite large, all the way down to about a gallon size or even smaller. And then you'll have some also inside the home that are smaller as well. And it's the larder, you know, it's the storage place for all of the staple foods.
Which is essentially everything that's fermented.
And beyond. And I mean, you have rock salt, you have gochugaru, you have...
Yeah, my grandmother would keep basically all the dry goods. But when yep. I think about ongi, though, I yeah. don't think about
sure,
that.
That's not the poster child.
No, I mean, it's like literally yeah. as like a Tupperware. I always think of it as that's the smelly shit. And all yeah. the smelly shit goes into the ongi.
Yeah. And so when I would walk from the pottery studio past the household where I was doing my apprenticeship, that smell would hit you in the head. You would be able to know you were walking by that because, yeah, it smells strong. And so all the jangs, all the sauces are kept in these jars. And then a lot of the kimchi ends up being buried. And so that's what you
we're,
know.
We're talking about no refrigeration, right?
Yeah, yep.
So everything had to be fermented.
Right.
But you're yep. making storage vessels for food.
Right.
And what was your wife at the time?
You know, she was not in the studio quite as much. She was enjoying connecting with her mother and relatives. And, you know, my work schedule when I got to Korea was 7 12-hour days, which I know for you is probably a little
no,
bit.
No, but like standard, I can also imagine in Korea, because like, that's what
yeah,
you do.
That's what you do. Yeah.
And you're making ongis. What was it like an epiphany? Like, I'm going to make ongis.
So I stupidly thought that I was going to get to do the traditional celadon carving, the sangam over there as well. And I'd just like split the week. And after day one, I was like, there is no way that I'm going to be able to pull this off for both of them. So I'm like, well, I have the most to learn by learning ongi.
And because no one makes it.
Well, and because it's the opposite end of the spectrum of what I had been doing already. I was working in porcelain and I was throwing on an electric wheel and I was wheel throwing, which is a very different construction method than ongi. And so with ongi, you're using a kind of iron-rich stoneware, which is different than porcelain. It's kind of more gritty in feel. And then you are making coils that are about 2.5 inches round by maybe 4 feet long. And you're attaching these coils in a basic cylinder form. And then you take a mallet on the inside of the pot and a paddle on the outside of the pot, and you compress it into the shape that you want for the fermenting jar. And all the while you're kicking this wheel with your foot, because I love pointing this fact out. This ongi tradition is the longest continuously practiced pottery tradition in the world at 5,000 years.
Wow.
There's older ones by far, but this one has been continuously practiced.
And ongis are still widely used throughout Korea.
Absolutely. And they did see a period where they started to drift because things like metal and plastic and glass came into favor and were affordable. But it turns out, fortunately, these jars have some breathability to them. And in the same way, I make the comparison to like an oak barrel. Mm. You know, you can make wine in a 2-liter Coke bottle if you want, but if you make it in that oak barrel, it's going to be a lot better. And that's essentially where these ongi jars fit. And so now you have these, what I would call like a micro brew of fermentation throughout Korea, and they make all the goods in a traditional ongi jar. And then they get packaged in a way that they can go out for mass consumption.
Right.
And on the label, it says made in a traditional ongi.
Before we go on, let's take another quick break to hear from our sponsors. Today's Dave Chang Show is brought to you by SimpliSafe. Do you know that only 1 in 5 homes have home security? Maybe because most companies really don't make it easy. That's why SimpliSafe is my top choice, hands down. SimpliSafe protects every door, window, and room with 24/7 professional monitoring. And they make it easy on you. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. Prices are always fair and honest. In fact, around-the-clock monitoring is just $15 a month. But the thing that truly makes SimpliSafe stand out is their video verification technology. When other home security systems are triggered, police often assume it's a false alarm, and the call goes to the bottom of the list. But not with SimpliSafe. Using their video verification technology, they are able to visually confirm that the break-in's happening, allowing police to get to the scene 3.5x faster. Visit simplysafe.com/Chang to get a free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. You've got nothing to lose. Now, be sure you go to simplysafe.com/Chang so they know our show sent you. That's simplysafe.com/Chang.
And now, back to the show. It's funny, as when my parents moved to Korea, or my grandmother, who cooked quite a bit, everything got modernized. And yeah, you have the jangs that are in plastic containers and stuff, but like the special stuff, the stuff that was made from hand, it was always in onggis.
Yeah.
So it's so funny, like, you take that for granted, but it's the one thing that was like a constant.
Yeah.
And no, we're keeping this outside, and this is the stuff.
Well, I mean, I will say there's the kimchi refrigerator. You know, we can't leave that out of the conversation, because that's a real part of it. And so a lot of households will have a separate refrigerator that's usually about the height of a dishwasher or something like that.
Yeah, small dishwasher.
Right?
I mean, my parents had one.
Yeah.
And it was on the deck.
Yep. Because it smells is part of it, and you want to keep it separate from the rest of your food. But it's just like its own separate thing. And so, you know, I think for household kimchi production, like that's a part of the conversation for sure.
But if you're going to make doenjang.
Yeah. You want to do it that way.
Yeah.
And another thing I love talking about with this, because the technology is so amazing for as far back as it goes, depending on what latitude you're at, an onggi is either more vertically oriented if you're further north, like in Seoul. And the further south you go, they get more shoulder and belly. And the reason for that is that things like doenjang and gochujang and kanjang, they all require a certain amount of heat from the sun. Mm. And so if you have more shoulder and you're down closer to the equator, then you need to have that more bellied out pot. And so I love the fact that they're thinking about that 5,000 years ago.
Wow.
You know?
That's like very noticeable to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would hear about it from the old timers in Korea. They, you know, they'd be telling me about the functionality from it. And at first I was like, is that real? But then, you know, I followed it up with some research, and that's how they function.
So you saw pretty early on, I'm going to make onggis.
Yeah, yeah. So I knew when I had to choose one or the other, obviously I'm going to choose the one where I have the most struggle and the most to gain.
And how many years did you start making?
So it was a one-year apprenticeship, and I got my ass handed to me every day when I was going in for this apprenticeship, because all the rules had been changed. And they're like, okay, make this pot, which if I could get an electric wheel and go back to how I had been making them, then no problem. But
were the Korean masters being jerks to you? Because you're a white guy.
Yeah. Well, in hindsight, they weren't
and
being
Koreans
jerks.
Koreans are not the nicest people to other. They're not nice to me.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, right. Like, they're very, I want to say xenophobic is the right word, but particular, you're not part of
your
their
inside
culture.
Or you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there were a few interesting stories. So about a month into my apprenticeship, I was told that I was going to be kicked out by the son, who was a few years older than me. And so got to the bottom of it, you know, got on the cell phone, and my wife was talking with my teacher's wife. And it turns out I clear my throat for the first couple hours in the morning. Well, I shouldn't have been clearing my throat in the presence of an, you know, national onggi master. And he had had enough. And my wife explained that I had no idea, and that I wasn't trying to, you know, pound my chest in front of this guy in his own space. And so after that, I would clear my throat outside. And he understood. He was actually really good about it. But a really funny thing that happened about 8 months into the apprenticeship is that it was starting to get warm during the summer. And my teacher, again, he was like 34, I think, at the time, and I was young, 30s. His wife would come out with watermelon and meisho cha, you know, the sour plum tea. And they would sit down like 3 feet to my side and watch me work. And I wasn't offered any of that. And I would have to like put my arms down, because literally I couldn't hold my arms up anymore, especially in the afternoon of doing this process. And his answer, or, you know, his comment on that was, "Way?
Why?
Why?" And I mean, it felt like he was being a jerk at the time, but I got to know him a lot better later on. And, you know, he actually was a pretty funny guy. So,
what a jerk.
But, well, yeah, a little bit. But historically, you'd get a backhand. And that's how the father that I learned under, the master, had learned at, from the age of 14. It was, you do it right or you get smacked. And so that had absolutely changed. But so I want to say, though, to finish a thought,
it's
earlier.
Also just, I know it's going to sound crazy. Yeah. Very Korean.
So
culture.
Korean. No, I mean, on the bus, you see an old person and they've got a stick. And if you mess with them, you're going to get hit.
It's very hard to explain to someone that doesn't know. And I can't justify it or rationalize it. Yep. But a lot of my Korean friends growing up in America, imagine how hard it is for these Korean immigrants. They don't know the customs.
That you and can't do
when
that.
You see how people are raised in Korea, it's tough love, man.
Yeah.
It's absolutely. Real tough love.
Yeah. And so in my time there, I ended up making and cutting in half 498 or so of these pots. And the only reason it's not 500 is that they would throw me a bone every once in a while when I was really desperate and they saw that I was having a hard time. And they'd say, oh, you can keep that one and we'll fire it.
And sell it.
No, and you get to keep it because we're not going to put an apprentice's pot in the sales area. Wow. And that's why, I mean, so I was cutting everything in half. And for me, that experience, but also making pottery is so much about the act of making pottery and not the finished product.
So this is basically your Uma Thurman in Kill Bill.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And you're much. Like, you're proficient, but you just got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I like to hear you talk about like this crew in the kitchen that has superpowers, because it's the same with clay. If I'm hanging out with a bunch of my clay friends at a conference or something like that, and they're like, damn, that's right. That guy is really, really good at this or that. Mm. And it's kind of amazing. You know, like we all have our faults and all that. But then when you get into the studio, yeah. So we've all done our training.
In pottery, and just a different note real quick.
Yeah.
With your peer group of like, you know, these very successful potters, can you be good and be bad at it? Can you be successful and be bad at your craft?
Well, I mean, there's a really strong movement that is definitely has a strong foothold here in New York, which is like the unskilled clay movement, where fine art artists have rediscovered clay. And so I think it frustrates a lot of craft-oriented potters and sculptors who have put a lot of effort into like honing their skill to see a fine artist who kind of has like a plop down of clay and a massive price tag on it. And so I think that would be the extreme. The way I look at it is it's all fair game. You know, it doesn't matter.
One of the things I want to go back to is I still, for the life of me, don't understand why a cup that looks like a five-year-old made it can be worth so much money. It still doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I understand when I look like a Ming vase or something like that. I'm like, wow, that is just like exquisite. And for me, it's like making the comparison. I was like, those old, beautiful, perfect Chinese pieces are like looking at Italian Renaissance masters. I'm like, wow, I understand that. That is beautiful.
Yeah.
When I look at something that like, I'm not trying to talk shit about Korean pottery. Like it's beautiful to me and I know it. And like you can see, I'm talking more about the real rough hewn stuff that it's hard for me to articulate when you need to see it.
Yeah.
But when you are like told by someone that is the most expensive thing you'll ever touch in your life, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Because is that like modern art, you know, the equivalent? Like the person that made that wasn't as skilled as the person in China, you know, that basically created, you know, bone china or like that kind of perfect porcelain.
Well, that points at a certain standard of what skill is though. I mean, I would say about that Korean pot that it's kind of like maybe appreciating a poem. And so in that wheel thrown form, maybe there are little chunks of rock in there. And as the clay shrunk around it, it started to crack. And so there's these little cracks around the edges of the stone. And that really points at these really almost like symbols for struggle. But then you have this clay that was really wet and soft at a certain point, and that has very soft fluid lines. And so maybe in a way this starts to talk about how life can be like real easy at sometimes, but there's always going to be some really difficult things as well.
But when you look at this, you're like, I could have done that.
I don't know. I mean, try making 500 of them. And then you realize that you can't.
I mean, that's the thing is I'm talking totally on my ass. I have no idea. Yeah, but when I think about it, I'm like, oh, if you can make that, I'm like.
No, but I look at it as somebody who has my 10,000 hours into working with clay and at certain points had tried to make work that looked like that. And it's not that easy. I mean, like there was something that those people had that a kid can't really copy.
I want to talk about the topic of Japanese taking Korean pottery and how do people feel about that? If you talk to a Japanese ceramicist, how do they respond to that?
I don't know. is the answer. I'd say that the most insight that I have on that is from the Korean side. And I think it's what you would expect. I think that there are bad feelings of, you know, what happened historically. From what I understand, there over hundreds of years have been kidnappings in both directions, almost like retribution kidnappings, which seems really crazy, like highly trained military personnel coming and grabbing people off of the beach.
For pottery.
Well, no. Not just for pottery, but that kind of thing. I think, you know, like, I don't know the exact dates, but I want to say, you know, like 13 generations back, there were a lot of Korean potters that got grabbed from Korea and taken to Japan because they were able to create something that was sought after.
By the emperor at the time who really desired it.
Yeah.
And what's essentially is a whole school of pottery that people think is Japanese had its origins.
Well, it definitely, there are influences, and that's not to undermine the quality of Japanese ceramics.
And that's what I need help, because I'm not trying to diminish it either, because there are plenty. I don't know what's Japanese and what's Korean-influenced Japanese.
Right.
That's
and
really
I think those lines are really, really blurred right now to where, I mean, I can tell you, like, Karatsu is very close to Korea, just on a map. And so I think that you get a lot of techniques that are very similar to the Ongi technique that I learned, where those lines are pretty blurred, because there was definitely exchange happening there. And whether that was like I explained from China, where there was a, you know, a trade person that was seeing that and then took it back home, or the actual kidnapping situation. I'm definitely not an expert on the specifics there.
It's actually fascinating to me, because I love Japanese, you know, aesthetic, culture, food. And it's something that I've always had to check myself on, because when I've done the tea ceremony and I'm looking at the stuff, those are the kinds of cups and vessels that are influenced by Korea. And those are the most expensive Japanese vessels, right? I mean, I know that much, right?
Yeah.
And yet it's really hard to determine what came from where.
Yeah.
Everything ultimately came from China. But it's the one thing that Korean culture can sort of call its own. And you are also making probably the only truly distinct Korean, like, pottery, as you say, for over 5,000 years that's continuously made in the Ongi. So you leave Korea, you go back to America.
Yeah, with a total identity crisis on my hands, because I've been making somebody else's pottery for a year. And so that muscle in my brain that says, okay, how do I decide what I'm going to make is definitely not in shape at that point. I mean, I saw a lot of great pots in Korea, but I was making one specific pot over and over and over again.
It's so funny when you say, I'm basically making clay Tupperware.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And there was part of me that was like, okay, this is sacred information that I was very lucky to get from my teachers. I have to proceed with extreme caution here. And so I end up going back to the work that I was making before Korea. And anytime I did make an fermenting vessel, an Ongi jar, it was to the exact specifications of my teachers with no signature of my own on it, and made as closely as possible as I could to what I'd learned. And that's the way that I've found that I feel like I can move forward with this, is like, if I'm doing it as a conduit to the information that my teachers shared with me, then it runs less of a risk of being, I mean, the phrase in my head is cultural appropriation. Hmm. I'm very sensitive about that. The last thing I want is to be like, hey, look at this thing that I invented. Check me out. If anything, you know, when I'm teaching these workshops, I really want to be the person who is sharing the story, because I am lucky to have a different audience than most of my Ongi teachers in Korea. And so that's where I feel like I have that responsibility that I want to share.
And you set up shop in Montana.
That's right. Yeah. So long story short, I came back from Korea and lived in Colorado for 5 years, is where my family's from. Again, wanting to be close to family, but had an opportunity to go to Montana. There's an artist residency center up there where I did 2 years, and my ex-wife, Hisu, did 2 years as well. And the kids dug in their roots there with school and everything, and we decided to stick around. And I was able to get a studio up and running at my home. And I sell almost all of my work online at this point through commission work.
And what's the website?
AdamFieldPottery.com.
And that's how we found you.
That's right.
We were planning Major Domo in LA, and we wanted it to have very subtle Korean elements because it was an homage to the Korea, great food of LA, but we didn't want it to be overt, right? Because we were not there either. And it was like, oh man, we're trying to celebrate weirdly American Korean food in that perspective, not Korean American. It's going to be American first with some Korean elements. And it was going to be the most Korean thing we've ever done at the time. And then Marguerite Mariscal said, hey, I found this guy. He's a white guy, but he lived in Korea, and he's like, he apprenticed under Ongi Master, and he's like based out of Montana. And like, I was like, whatever. And then I was like, this guy can't make anything good. And she's like, no, seriously, take a look at some of the Ongis that he's making. I'm like, wow, those are beautiful. And they, and they look great. And, you know, I was really, really happy that that happened, you know, quite frankly, because it was the perfect fit for us because we didn't want to import anything from Korea.
Yeah.
Because most of the Ongis that you see, and you, if you go to a Korean market or something, they're all, for the most part, from Korea.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, wow, this might be the only American that sells or makes Ongis. Is that true still right now?
Yeah, I mean, traditional functional Ongi jars. Yeah, absolutely.
And they're definitely functional. We pickle a whole lot of shit in them.
Yeah.
In the, a variety of sizes. So we have a bunch of your Ongis in Major Domo, and we're very honored.
And well, it's amazing for me to know that you guys are fermenting in them. I'll hear from Mark Johnson sometimes. He'll shoot me a message and like, oh yeah, we're fermenting this and that. And I'm like, I don't think I've ever heard of anybody fermenting like passion fruit seeds or something like that in an Ongi jar. So it's really fascinating to be working in this traditional historical vein of clay, but then to get those in the hands of you guys is thrilling. So
what else do you have going on?
Well, I'm regularly teaching workshops, and so I always have a workshops page on my website that I point people to, and that's AdamFieldPottery.com. And I'm really active on Instagram, so people can find me AdamFieldPottery. It's an albino gorilla, just like me.
And again, your Ongis are beautiful, and if you guys are out there looking to make some pickles or anything fermented, it is a vessel designed for that. Literally.
Yeah. So,
and they're beautiful, and you're supporting an artist that makes terrific work and has spent time in Korea, and I think really gets it. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Our pleasure. Thanks for listening to the podcast with Adam Field. Big fan of his work. Very excited that we get to showcase his work at Major Domo and future restaurants. And hopefully, whenever we get to LA, which is soon, we'll be able to ferment stuff in my backyard. Can't wait to have a backyard and make my own jangs, doenjang, gochujang, kangjang, all the beautiful Korean fermented foods in my backyard. Gonna really get to town in the Ongis. So excited that we get to talk about it, and excited as I sort of get older, I'm able to share my experiences on one of the few things I have some knowledge on, which is Korean pottery. Outside of that, I don't know that much. So thank you again, Adam. So check out his work, check out his website, and invest in an Ongi. You're not going to regret it. I really think it's one of the best things you can have to ferment and to store foods. It's something I grew up with. I remember being able to get rice from an Ongi. My mom would store all the rice in an Ongi right outside our back door. So I want to get to an Ask Dave at MajorDomoMedia.com question. And Charles Smith basically is asking the same question a bunch of you guys have emailed in to Ask Dave at MajorDomoMedia.com. It's very similar. So he asks, Charles asks, when you decided to go out on your own and open a Momofuku, did you have any base knowledge of how to run a business? And when it comes to the business side of things, where did you start? No, I had no base knowledge of anything. Number one, when I started Momofuku, I couldn't get anyone to work with me. I got a lot of help to create a pro forma. Like, you know, at the time, I didn't know where to find something on the internet, and it just seemed rudimentary. And buying books, you just knew that you can't cut and paste this stuff. So I knew I just needed to have a realistic assessment of what my numbers might look like moving forward and how we could pay back a loan and how we could actually stay afloat. But like quickly when I was making those projections, and I'm not a wizard at all in accounting, I was like, oh, this is all bullshit. Creating a menu, you know, this is all make-believe shit. So I had no idea what I was doing because the prospect and the sort of the labor that is needed to get permitting, construction, raising the money, paying the bills, it's a nightmare. And, you know, it's really starting right off the bat if you open a restaurant with project management because you have to keep an eye on your bank account and make sure you just can't like scrape by, which ultimately every restaurant does that I know of. You basically open up when you're not ready, but you have to because you can't bleed cash anymore. So it's never an ideal thing, and it's highly stressful. And then even though I grew up with my dad owning a golf store and he was in the restaurant business but sold it when I was like 2 years old, so I know nothing, that just doesn't transfer through osmosis. I didn't learn shit, and it was all trial and error. And you get an accountant and you just figure shit out. And I just created my own system of running the accounting, which proved to be problematic down the road because like things get lost, you add things wrong. And that's why ultimately you have to get an accountant and then you've got to drop the money off at the local bank. It was just sort of the day-to-day shit that you figure out. And then making sure you have enough money to do a sales tax, figuring out if you can even stay afloat is a terrifying prospect. And ultimately, I learned business because you have no choice. So it's not something I recommend, and I wish that I had a better mentor, but honestly, between creating a menu, operating the restaurant, and then also running it as a business, those are three completely different roles that entrepreneurs or restaurant owners, or let's just say any small business, they got to figure out, and it's incredibly stressful. And I don't really look back on it fondly because every day, every week, you had to do payroll. You're literally thinking, do I have enough money to make this fucking work? How do I stretch the bills? How do I sort of like go 30 days out on like the meat, or how do I do COD on the fish? And it's just a nightmare, man. And I'm not scarred by it, but I simply saying like, if you're thinking about starting a business, there's nothing you can really do to prepare it unless you've been doing it. And if you are working in a business and you have the sort of freedom, let's just say you work at a restaurant, use that opportunity to ask questions. Ask what kind of accounting software they use. Ask who their payroll is, how they do their payroll, who handles their taxes, how do they file all their information, right? The biggest thing is filing away receipts, filing away Oyster tags. It's just constantly logging information, checking in, checking out for employees, accounting for overtime. God damn it. It's a lot, but you don't have to learn this on the go. I just never asked this shit when I was working for other people, and I regret that I didn't. And still, even if you know that knowledge, it's incredibly difficult to do. So that being said, I got a lot of help asking Tom Colicchio and the whole team at Kraft, who was very, very patient and gave me a lot of information, as well as Marco Canora, my old chef. Both Tom and Marco were my chefs, and then Marco left to open up Hearth on 13th Street and First Avenue with Paul Greco. And I remember just badgering them for all the help humanly possible. And at the end of the day, it's the network and the neighborhood and the community. But ultimately, no one at that time actually wanted to work with me. I just needed help. So just grinded it out. It's not something that I got good at by studying. I got good at it because I had to learn and I needed to stay in business. So when it comes to the business side of things, you start by just doing it. And you can read all the books you want, but you will inevitably never know what it's like unless you actually have the pressure, right? The clock is ticking and you have to make decisions about leases, about real estate decisions, about the future growth of your company. And ultimately, I always take the position that the best way to side is on paranoia. And not negatively, but it's like rationally paranoid thought about all the things that might happen. I can't speak for any other kind of business, but ultimately, I like to protect and prepare for all the worst case scenarios, because inevitably that's the shit that happens. I think I answered your question. I didn't go too deep into it because maybe we'll flesh this out in a much longer podcast. Anyway, I've spoken long enough. Thank you for that question, Charles. Take it easy, everyone. Please give us 5 stars however you vote or rate this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. Thank you so much, guys. Take it easy. Talk to you next week.